Hi, I'm Sarah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sarah.
I'm from Richmond, Virginia. My sobriety date is November 3rd, 2020, and my home group is Buford Road Group on Wednesday nights in Richmond, Virginia. And I have a sponsor. I sponsor other women, and I'm very active in Alcoholics Anonymous in the Richmond area. So I'm gonna stick to the format that's suggested here, share what I was like, what happened, what I'm like now. In Zoom, they can only see like my nose up, so it looks really funny. This is what I So I'll just start from the beginning. I grew up in Charlottesville, Virginia, and I'm the youngest of three children. I grew up, I know our book says we can't diagnose anyone as alcoholic, right? But I'll say, growing up in Charlottesville, my dad did drink a lot, and his drinking definitely affected me, the family, and the way things were. And I had a good childhood, I'll say. I had a good childhood, just, middle class family. My mom was a stay-at-home mom, and it's weird. So to be fully transparent, I feel a little blocked because my brother's here. So it makes me just like a little nervous a little bit, but I'm still just going to be very honest. My purpose is hopefully to help anybody that might still be sick and suffering. So, but it did affect me. There was the type of child I was. I feel like I was quiet. I didn't cause a lot of trouble or anything. With dynamics going on in the home, like a lot of my parents fought a lot of stuff, like there would be an episode, the police coming to our house, like those kinds of things. And I grew up, it really affected my insides, okay? And the way, and my mother, then the way it was handled. So now that I'm an adult and I have recovery, I could see how abnormal that is to grow up in, but I didn't know any better as a child, and that's what was normal for me. And so my mom did the best she could, and her way of coping, and we just had to pretend that nothing was wrong, right? So even though there'd be an episode and something traumatic would happen, we'd still have a family dinner together, but just pretend that nothing happened, right? And this is normal to me at that time. But it did affect me, and affected me as I grew up. This that my nervous system was just constantly jangled up, honestly. And that's stuff that I have to look at in recovery today, because my body can be primed. If nothing's even going on, I can be naturally kind of primed with this jangled up nervous system in fight or flight, right? And it's response to how I was kind of programmed growing up. But my parents, they did love us. We took family trips. They tried their best. I know my dad really loved me. We had special moments. He would take me to play golf at McIntyre Park. We'd go out for tacos. I know that's the thing, with my own alcoholism, I know how when I was deep in the cups, the way I treated my children. I have a 16 and 19-year-old, and it's not that I never loved them. I just couldn't show up for them the way that I had hoped or wanted to. I just couldn't do it. So, just from a very early age, I start adopting these ideas that in order to be okay in the world and to feel secure and safe, I just have to be perfect. I have to get good grades. And that was kind of my outlet, right? This like perfectionist standards through school. So I was always like a teacher's pet. I worked really hard in school. I made straight A's. I joined clubs. I had a hard time making friends, honestly. I would have like one close friend at a time for a long period of time, but I was just too kind of inward and shy to ever join the popular crowd or people that had a lot going on, because I just never felt okay inside. I never felt okay in my own skin, and I wouldn't have known how to connect with them. And to also kind of make me feel a little different, I had scoliosis. I was diagnosed as a teenager. I had to wear a back brace. Braces. I was just like super awkward, and all these things that just made me not feel okay inside, like that I just wasn't a part of, and I wasn't like everybody else. So I really just, again, focused on my studies because that was like the one thing that I felt like I had control over and gave me security in the world. It's funny, our big book talks about there's this fundamental idea of God inside every person, and I can see from a very young age being naturally spiritually minded, and I attended Catholic Church with my family, but it didn't really come from that. I kind of had a different scope, and I would try to tap into the spiritual life, like spirituality for me. I remember I had a tarot card deck, and I was really into kind of like the witchy stuff, and that was just fun. I played with crystals and I played in the woods a lot. This was in the 80s, right? So there wasn't like really electronics at that time. And I was just in nature. I played outside a lot. And I remember, especially being in the woods, I would feel connected to something. I would feel stillness. I would feel peace. I would have these moments of just okayness where I didn't need any external thing extra to make me feel okay. And I remember those like profound moments of presence still. I would sneak off sometimes when my parents were fighting. I would sneak off to outside to the top of our shed that was in the yard, and I would just lay on the roof of the shed. And so that this is just how I kind of learned to cope and handle it. The first time I drank, I think I was like 14 years old, and I remember loving it. It was New Year's Eve at my sister's apartment, and there was a Christmas tree. And I definitely remember the feeling of that effect produced by alcohol, like right out of the gate. I mean, I had a psychic change. It was absolutely a spiritual experience for me. The first time I took my first full drink, the room lit up. I could still picture it in my mind. It's weird, right? Like, I can't do that with a lot of things, but I remember the placement of the tree and just how I felt. I felt connected. I felt that feeling of peace, like I felt outside. I felt okay in my skin and everything felt wonderful. And the allergy of alcohol has always been present in me. That I never grew into that. I feel like I was probably born with it because, like, the first time I drank, I experienced that phenomenon of craving. So, while I had that, brief spiritual experience and, that feeling of okayness, just from my very first time getting drunk, I overshot the mark. I was throwing up. But, the next day, I was so young, it didn't faze me, right? I didn't get hangovers or anything like that. So, I only drank a few other times in high school. And it never affected my grades or anything like that. I don't feel like I had the obsession of the mind quite yet. But I ended up going to college, and I went to an out-of-state college, which was a huge party school. And something happened to me. It's like living in the house I lived in, I was so constricted. Like my in and I don't even think it since it was normal for me at the time, I wouldn't have been able to tell you that's what was going on with me. But I'll tell you, I chose on purpose to go to an out-of-state school so that I could get away from home. I thought that's just what I need to get far away from here and just start a new life. And I drank very heavily at that school. There were no boundaries, okay? And I was only 17 years old when I went to college, but it was a place where, I mean, my fake ID was so, it was so bad. And there was like a poster board and they cut out a thing and you stood and you like held your face in the poster board and smiled. So it was like this really janky fake ID. And I paid $50 for it, but it would work at these bars because they didn't care anyway. My daughter is a 19-year-old at UVA right now, and her fake IDs, they are so legit. You cannot tell at all that they're fake. It's crazy. I mean, it has the hologram and everything. So, yeah, I was just drinking. And even then, I was partying with people who seemed like they were partying like me, but I guess not, because I would get a lot of, Sarah, you have a problem. Like, you actually have a problem. I'd be like, what? And I would just blow it off. And then I remember there being an incident at the school where I had passed out in the snow. And my friend and I, because this was in West Virginia, and so it was one of those like major snows that we don't get anymore, but 10 feet deep or something. And we We had pre-gamed and we were drinking Southern Comfort and Jack Daniels and just drinking it straight. And that's the thing. I've always been able to do that with alcohol because I am somebody, I absolutely drink for the effect. I would drink gasoline if it would get me hammered. I don't care. You know, I'm not picky. But anyway, so we were pre-gaming and drank a ton of liquor and wearing like just scantily clad to go to the bars. And an RA, somebody from the dorm, found us passed out in the snow on the way to the bars. And from that event, I had to meet with the school board, and they were saying how they wanted to call my parents and let them know. And I was just terrified. I promised, like, I'll do anything. Just please don't call my parents. It was a one-off. I'd never drink. And they bought it, right? I think I had to go to like a couple of classes, and that was it. I was not introduced to AA. You know, AA, it's funny. We get so many young people in Richmond now, college students that are sober. Back then, it didn't seem like a thing. And I wish it had been, but I don't know that I would have grabbed onto it. But so that was my college life. After my second year of college, I was home for the summer. And I got this boyfriend that I became so obsessed with, right? And this would be a pattern for me, like looking to the outside world to fix me and make me okay. Like I would look to these external things, especially boyfriends, to provide me with the security that I felt I needed to be okay. And I became so obsessed with this man that I could not bear the thought of like going back to college without him, that I literally dropped out of school to stay home with him for the summer. But you know, nobody wants to be with a person like that. It's like a vampire, right? Just like suck the life out of somebody. And he broke up with me and I was devastated. And I remember my mom, and I just, again, back then it was just so different, you know, just pull yourself up by your bootstraps. There was just no processing, no talking about it. That's just how I was raised. Like you deal with it, go brush your hair, wash your face, put on some makeup, come to dinner. And then I remember my mom drove me to UVA to take typing tests so I could get a secretary job at the university. And I think about my mom, who it breaks my heart, honestly. And every time I pass that building, because I said my daughter goes to UVA, I just remember that. And I try to put myself in my mom's shoes, like, here was this child that I was such an outstanding student, you know, just decorated, honors, all this stuff. Only 2 years later, now she's driving me to this, you know, just the best hope I had was to hopefully get my foot in the door of the secre as a secretary in the cop in the university. And I just, it's just, it's so, I don't like thinking of it, but that's what happened. And I could just, I'm in a place today where I can put myself in other people's shoes, right? So I think of that. My mom's deceased, by the way, both my parents are. So that's what happened. You know, I got a secretary job at the college and I got a little studio apartment in Hogwaller in Charlottesville. And my routine was I would work as a secretary at the hospital and I would get a six pack of Miller Lite every night for the way home. I'd stop by the gas station by my house. I'd get a six pack of Miller Lite and I had a prescription for Ambien. So this is what would get me through the day at work. Like I would actually be excited when I would think about it, like, oh, 5 o'clock's gonna come. I'm gonna get my six pack, take my Ambien. It's gonna be fun. And I'd go home and just sit and watch TV and take my Ambien, drink my six pack, get super loopy and messed up. And I loved it. You know, when you take that drug and drink so much, it's like I couldn't even like walk to my bed most times, but I loved it. Like it didn't, you know, I remember falling on the floor and that's, you know, it's kind of freaky, you know, it's like you think about it, but I was in heaven. I loved it because that's just this emphasis on just blocking everything out and not feeling everything, anything, like that's just where I liked to be. And again, I was young, early 20s now, so the hangovers weren't that bad. I would take care of it if they were, you know, a little hair off the dog or whatever I needed to do, but I'd be at work the next day. I didn't miss work. So that was life in Charlottesville for a few years. I met a friend that drank just like me, and we would go to the bars and just all like kind of just crazy, weird stuff would happen when we'd be out. It's so It was just so chaotic, okay? Just chaos, like the way I drank and the situations I would get myself into. And I got a job then on the downtown mall, and I met my husband, that's my ex-husband now. And I really thought, the thing about meeting this man is I thought again, I was like, wow, this is all I've needed is to just get married. He was from a good family. And again, this is the outside thing. This is just how I am. And I could still be like this in sobriety, just like kind of grasping for an external solution for an internal problem. But I didn't know any other way then. And I was like, I grabbed onto this marriage, and early married life with him and being with him was really fun because we would, drink a lot, we'd smoke a lot of weed, we'd take camping trips and hiking trips, and I just didn't have a care in the world. I was still young and life seemed bright. The future seemed bright. It was like a Bill Wilson moment, right? Like early in a story, like I felt like I had arrived and it's just always going to be like this. And I didn't know about the progressive nature of alcoholism, right? It was good then. And things did start taking a nosedive when I had my first daughter because, again, I just part of my programming growing up was this is what you do. You get married, you have kids, and that's it. I don't know. I didn't have any kind of way to like think beyond that, right? And again, everything's just focused on the externals. So I tried to make that happen. When we had our first daughter, that's when things started to tank because I was trying to not drink. Because I was pregnant. And it was okay when I was pregnant to not drink. And I'll say, so this is funny. I tell my daughter this, okay? She's very bright and smart. But when I took my pregnancy test and I found out I was pregnant with her, I had drank 20 Coronas the night before. And I tell her that, and I think it's hilarious. And everybody's always like, oh, but she's fine. But the only reason I know the amount of Coronas that I drank was because my husband and I were having a party the night before, and I was the only one drinking beer. So when we did the gas station run, I needed more beer. So that's the only way I was able to gauge the amount. But of course, I was like freaked out the whole pregnancy and like Googling fetal alcohol syndrome. But by God's grace, she's healthy. Anyway, so after she's born, though, I'm trying really hard not to drink because I'm breastfeeding, and it was really difficult for me. Like I didn't know this is what was going on, but looking back now, like not having alcohol in me and not being able to drink, I was awful to be around. I mean, just pins and needles, just blowing up, like explosive, annoyed, like mad at my husband, constantly ripping his head off. He would work all day. And when he would come home, man, if he was 5 minutes late, I would rip his head off. I would let him have it. And it's just really sad to think about, but I didn't know that's what was going on. Like I needed alcohol. And as soon as I could start drinking again, I was drinking again and things got a little better. But then kind of what happens in my life, so here's where I end up, having a son, and it's the same thing. I could be good and I could like, pull myself up by my bootstraps when I'm pregnant and not drink. I can do that. I know some women can't, but I was able to. But what ends up happening, my son was born 3.5 years after my daughter. And this is where in my life, there's just this shotgun blast in my life. Okay. And this is the truth about what happened to me. And I don't like to, I just want to say, like, I'm not a victim, trust me. Like, but this is literally what happened in my life. My son gets sick and hospitalized. It turns out he has a chromosome disorder that we didn't pick up on because everything was seemingly normal, even when he was born, but he wasn't eating. This led to hospitalizations. It turned out he had medical problems with feeding. He had to be put on a feeding tube for the first 5 years of his life. The same day that he was admitted to the hospital for that, I tried to call my mom to tell her, and my dad picked up the phone and said my mom was in the hospital. She had suffered this really devastating like gastro problem, and that would end up putting her in hospice. So she died like 30 days after that event. And my son's in the hospital. There's all this uncertainty with his condition. My drinking went off the Richter scale. And that's when I purposefully started drinking because I was a stay-at-home mom, right? And I had to care for the son. I was responsible for putting feeding tubes before we knew, before he got a G tube, which is a permanent solution for that. I was having to put like a feeding tube up his nose. And I would have to like bound him in a blanket. And the only way that I could cope with that was to like drink. And so I would start drinking in the morning and I would be putting whiskey in my tea, Kahlua in my coffee. I would start the morning right. And my plan was that this is, I really always tried to get a certain buzz. Like I wanted a certain level buzz. And my intention was to just keep it, right? Like level three. Okay. But, you know, I was just, I'm never able to do that. So by, you know, by the evening, I'd just be hammered. I started going out to bars, you know, because I'd tell my husband, I need to like get out. And then the next thing I know, I'm drinking worse than I did when I was in college. And he ends up throwing me out, like rightfully so. He did the right thing. So I lost my marriage. And so all within this few months span, that's what I mean by a shotgun blast. And I had just lost my mother. And I got this like really just janky apartment in the Fan in Richmond. And it was, when I think back, it was kind of gross. And I think about just my drinking, and I was absolutely in survival mode. I was just in survival. I would get a babysitter sometimes so that I could go out. And I remember the way I had the allergy as an alcoholic. I remember I had a case of beer in the fridge, and I got a babysitter, and I told her. It's weird. I was so sneaky about my drinking, but I can't explain it. I was being sneaky about it, even though nobody was watching. I was just like in that insanity. And I remember I had this case of beer in the fridge, and the sitter comes, and I'm in the kitchen. Like before I go out, she's in the other room with the kids, and I'm in the kitchen, like crouching with the door open, and I'm like chugging beers as fast as I can so she doesn't see me with the door like this. Just crazy. But I couldn't not drink, and my body was craving it. I think that this, I don't mean to sound too out there, but it absolutely feels like possession. I swear to God, it feels like possession, that there's something else going on when I'm deep in the cups like that. So what ends up happening, I end up coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew about it through my brother, right? He was never shoving it down my throat. He would just come visit and be present and, you know, say things. I remember like he was planting seeds. I remember one time disclosing to him like just how profoundly lonely I felt. Like I just felt so alone. By this time, I had lost any friend that I had. I was definitely a lone wolf going to the bars alone. And he would say things like, that sounds a lot like what I have, that loneliness, and that's alcoholism. So what was kind of being revealed to me is that there's something else with this other than just the way I drink, that there's more to this illness. And it didn't make sense to me until after I got sober the first time. And I got sober August 15th, 2011 in Richmond, and I got a sponsor right away. And I just started doing the things, right? I got a home group, I got a sponsor, I got plugged in, I became part of a fellowship, I was service active, and I got better. My life got better. I got a good job, I got promoted, you know, and then 5 years in, again, you know, what happens 5 years in? I started just getting annoyed with the program. And what was happening was, I was definitely not perfecting and enlarging my spiritual life. That just wasn't important to me. I honestly don't think it was really even being shared about in meetings, right? And I was just kind of doing this mechanical way of AA, and I definitely was not even doing the disciplines in the big book. I was not doing like a regular morning 11 step or evening. I was not doing 10 step watching. I was definitely not working with other women. I was really just having this like half-butted approach to recovery, honestly. And of course, something shiny comes along, this good-looking man, mountain bike scene, and I get in a relationship with him. And the next thing I know, you know, we're in that cult mountain bike culture. It reminds me of in Bill's story, he talks about when you're reading Bill's story, there's this part where he's like, now he's talking about playing golf and Walter Hagen. It's just super random. And he picks golf. It's exposed because it allows for drinking all day long. Okay. So it's alcoholism, pick golf. My alcoholism, I feel like that story, my alcoholism picked this mountain bike culture because part of the culture is just smoking weed in the woods and hanging out at breweries after bike rides. So for somebody like me, if I'm not like in recovery, involved, working with people, perfecting, enlarging my spiritual life, all the things, and you put an untreated person like me in breweries regularly around people who are drinking and looking like they're having fun, I mean, it's just going to make sense for me to drink. And the way it happened, though, I broke my wrist in a mountain bike accident and I got a prescription for painkillers, and the pain was never even that bad. I could have taken Advil, honestly, but I started abusing them just coming out of the gate. Just there was no do not pass go. I was already taking them like four and five at a time to the point that I flushed them down the toilet because I was afraid I was going to accidentally kill myself. But I was like chasing that effect so hard, and then I felt like I had blown my sobriety, so I drank, okay? And I remember that boyfriend of mine, remember telling him, like, I want to drink. He's like, are you sure? I was like, yeah. He's like, well, I'm not gonna stop you. And the first beer I had, so remember, I'd been sober for 5 years. The first beer I had, I remember, like, just when I look back now, I see that insanity, like, just insane. I was so excited to drink. I was like shaking. I was just like so excited. And honestly, that's how my recovery has to be today. Like, I have to stay inspired and excited about this thing to the level that I was excited about drinking. And that's just what I have found this go around. It's been a different experience. But I drank a beer with him, and I remember I immediately got that effect. Okay. That first one worked. Nothing seemed wrong at first. And that's what's so tricky about this. But I promise you, I never got that feeling again. And I was out for 4 years, but I never got that feeling that I got from that first beer with him. But I remember him saying, okay, I was house sitting and we had to take these dogs for a walk. And he's like, okay, are you ready to go walk the dogs now? And I remember just clamming up and being like, I'm not walking the dogs, I'm drinking now. Right? It's like the allergy was just so. And I agreed to walk the dogs with him. And I remember like pulling these German shepherds, like, come on, and just being, so restless until we could get home. And then I could just drink. So the problem is, my drinking is just so unmanageable when I drink. It's like, I know that we all suffer from the same thing. So just that like super explosive, highly volatile, just life just gets crazy very quickly. And I was out for 4 years, but I'll say during that time, I did keep trying to come back to AA. And I would come back to AA and I would pick up a white chip because it was just so unmanageable. Like, I freak myself out when I drink. Like, and I know I freak out other people, but I definitely was freaking out myself. So I'd like pick up a white chip and I would mean it with all my, every time I picked up a white chip, I meant it. I'm not going to drink again. But then something would happen. I remember this one time. I had gotten 30 days. It was not even on my mind to go drink. Anytime I drank again, it was never on my mind during the day, right? But I remember it was my boyfriend's birthday. I had just gotten a 30-day chip. I was super jazzed about it. And we went to a Capital Ale House. And you could order flights of beer and still no thought of drinking. I'm sitting at the bar with him, but no thought of drinking. And then it just occurs to me, just occurs to me out of nowhere, that I want to try some samplers. And the woman was like, well, which ones do you want to try? I said, what's the highest alcohol content one? Seriously. And she gets the two highest ones for me. And I drink them both and I choose the one that it's a beer that tastes just like bourbon. It's so like they can get really high alcohol content beers now. And I get that one. And again, I'm off to the races. And during that 4 years, I did keep trying to just I would make resolutions like I'm only gonna smoke marijuana. That's it. It's like that's it. And No matter what, I'm not going to drink. Okay. So, but what, the important lesson that I was learning during that time that I'm glad that I have today is I am not somebody that can just not drink no matter what. So I would smoke weed, I'd be doing that. But what would always happen inevitably is I just couldn't get as high as I wanted. Right. So I'd just drink. But then it would be so crazy and unmanageable that I'd end up back in AA. Right. So it's just like this cycle. Then COVID hits. Now it's 4 years in. So it's just, 4 years in and out, in and out. And I remember the world was locked down now at COVID, and now I'm working from home. And my drinking was just like off the chain working from home. And I remember my boss called me in one time, like into the office. So she calls me in because I had had this fight with my direct manager. So the director calls me into the office, and I was terrified because she said that I had to come in then as soon as possible. But I had drank a giant can of some really strong dark beer. I don't know what. And I had to go in. So I was terrified. But I was like wearing a mask. And I remember just having a breakdown in her office. Just emotionally unhinged, just no emotional center of gravity. And I remember this woman, she was a Southern woman, and she just looked at me and she said, "Sarah, you need to have more of an evenness about you." And I thought, like, no, SHIT, right? Like, I know that. I know. And I just felt crazy. I decided that I would come back to AA when meetings opened up again in person. That I just decided that's what I was going to do. But again, it just got too dark and too unmanageable. So November 3rd, when I came back to AA, the world was still shut down. But I remember I called a woman that I had been friends with before. And, I'll say the last night of my drinking, it terrified me, honestly, because it was over a Halloween weekend. I was part of this mountain bike group, and every night starting on October 30th, there was this giant event where we would just be blowing it out, keg parties, that kind of thing. And by the time Monday hit, that was, I think, November 2nd. When Monday hit, I remember being in the shower, or maybe it was November 1st, my time. But I remember being in the shower and thinking, I am not drinking the whole month of November because that was crazy. Like, that was crazy. I can't drink like that. The problem is drinking in my 40s, like drinking in your 40s, that ski jump is really real. I mean, it was just way worse than it had ever been. And the hangovers, like my health was just really declining. So I'm in the shower, I'm like, I'm never drinking again. And I just meant it. I meant it. And I was drunk that night. And I remember going out with another mountain biker, and that night, I had to work the next day, and I'm drinking on an empty stomach. Then we're at a bar taking shots, and then I ate a handful of psychedelic mushrooms at midnight and riding my bike around town with this guy. And I remember I just did not sleep at all that night, and I remember just being so freaked out. And the next morning, so I never really went to sleep, but the next morning I had to log into work. And I remember, oh, actually, we were able to come to the office 2 days a week at this point. I remember just waking up terrified and sitting on the edge of my bed. I had fleas in my house. There was a flea infestation. My legs were eaten up. I'm looking at my flea bites, and I just was so out of it. And I remember I stood up because I knew I had to get dressed for work. And I stood up and I just broke. I yelled the F word as loud as I could. And then I hit my knees and I put my elbows on the bed and I just prayed so hard. I said, "God, please help me. Just please help me." I was flattened. I was so flattened. And the place where I worked at the time is a religious place. And they have a chapel on site, and I made it in on time to clock in. And then I just went and I sat in the chapel for a really long time, and I just sat there silently. And the thing is, sitting in the chapel, the thing that's sad about it is I wasn't even praying for help. I didn't even have the wherewithal to pray, honestly. I was just sitting there, just I knew I was going to die of alcoholism. I just did in that moment. Like, I knew I was going to die of alcoholism, and there was nothing I could do about it because I just was able to see how much I kept saying I wanted to stop and not being able to. I just knew it. And it just, that experience now looking back, I think about surrender and what it means to me. And it really taught me that I can't bring about my own surrender. It's an act of something else. It's greater than me. Like, if I can bring around about my own surrender, I would have done it. Like, I would have done it way sooner and saved myself all the drama. But I can't do it. I can't surrender. What ends up happening is I find myself surrendered after trying to surrender, and then I just end up in the state, hey, I'm surrendered. I know I'm going to die of alcoholism. I can't do anything about it. And I did. I had sort of a. So here's what's freaky about this story now. This is my white light experience that I had. I drive home after that. I worked the rest of the day. I drive home. And I remember sitting in my driveway, and I knew I had alcohol and drugs in my house. And I was scared to walk into my door because I understood I'd had enough experience that even though I'm saying right now I don't want to drink or get high, I have no idea if I'm going to change my mind by the time I get to the door. See, that's what I'm up against with this thing. Like, that's why I need to be really involved in AA. That's what I'm up against is this thought just coming out of nowhere that I had no defense about, that if it said go get beer at the gas station, boom, done. And so I had stuff in the house and I was scared to go to the door. And I called my friend that I had an AA before. And what's weird, so she picked up the phone, first of all. This is a woman that travels all the time, all over the state. She has one of those Sprinter vans. She's never home. She's very busy. She sponsors like a bunch of women. And so she's just not reachable. She'll call you back, but you can't. For her to pick up the phone was strange. And I remember she said, Sarah Board. I said, hey. And I said, where are you? Because I felt like, where are you in the country? And she said that she's like, I'm standing on the Nickel Bridge. And her husband had passed away right before I had gone back out to drink. And he was in recovery, and I was really close with them. They were like family to me, and he had passed away of a sudden illness. And 2 weeks before this event that I'm telling you about, now I know I was out of my mind and stuff, but I swear this is true. Okay. 2 weeks before all this happened, when I was driving across the Nickel Bridge, I saw her husband riding a bike, and he wasn't wearing a helmet or anything. He was just riding. He looked happy. He looked free. And I remember like, being like, that's John. Is that John? And I like, braked and I looked and it was, and I just remember thinking at the time, like, that's crazy. Like, and I had thought about calling her then, but I'm like, I had been estranged from this woman. So I felt she's not going to want to hear that I just saw her dead husband. Okay. Because I didn't know how that would affect her. So I just washed it off. But when she answered the phone and said where she was actually standing in the location where I saw him riding the bike. And I just knew, you guys, I don't know if I sound crazy right now, but I know it with all of my soul. That was my window. Like, that was my window. And I knew it was coming from God. And I said, I need help. And she said, well, I'm in Richmond, so why don't you come over tonight? I was like, okay. And I just knew that this was like a window of opportunity, and I didn't want to lose it. Like, I just knew that's what was happening. It was like in me. So I go to her house that night. I'm really hungover, and she's talking to me like, she's looking at her calendar, pulling up her phone. She's like, we're gonna go do this in 3 months. I have to go speak here. You'll have 3 months of sobriety. And she was already talking like I was sober, like it was the most normal thing in the world. And she told me where the Zoom AA meetings, like which ones to go to. And I was like, okay. So I started AA on Zoom, and it was not fun, I'll say. Okay. The first 2 weeks, just trying to get sober on Zoom because they hadn't opened up meetings spaces in Richmond yet. It was very lonely. I didn't have the luxury of going to meetings and having fellowship and getting out of my house myself. So I remember just like crying a lot, being really lonely. I would go to Zoom meetings and I would look at people share who had gotten sober after me before. And these people were so like together. I remember thinking like, wow, like, 'cause I was not together and I did not feel like them. And I still, I'll say the first week or two, I did not think AA was going to work. I just didn't. I was just really on edge, scared of the thought coming into drink again. And I wasn't sure if AA was going to work again. But then 1 to 2 weeks in, what happened is the cool thing about getting sober on Zoom is it opened up meetings in other areas. And I happened upon this meeting and this man was sharing, and I don't even know what he was talking about, but I remember being like, wow, I want what he has. Like his message was powerful, the way he carried himself. He was interesting to listen to. He was talking about spiritual experience, about doing the disciplines in AA. And I just saw the way he was, and I was like, I want what he has. And then the first man that shared after him shared about drinking again after 19 years of sobriety. And he also had this really powerful message with depth and weight. And that meeting literally was my flimsy read. That was the first moment that I thought, okay, I think I can do this. Like, I can stay sober for this. And I did. I started attending this weekly emotional sobriety workshop that had all these people that were practicing this way of life, practicing about talking about deepening spiritual experience, about emotional sobriety through the steps. So it wasn't like anything I'd ever been used to. And it was so powerful to me. So I ended up going to a conference in 2021 to meet all these people in Colorado. And they opened this conference, because it had been closed the year before for COVID. And I just remember being in that room and meeting AAs from all over and really being drilled into me at the time, or, like they were really advocating about the disciplines in each of the steps, like really putting this into your life and how the perfecting and enlarging your spiritual life and making that just so interesting and paramount and the priority. And I've really just kind of held on to that ever since. I got a sponsor at that conference, and she lives in Seattle, Washington, but we met on Zoom. She took me through the steps that way. And when I said my third step prayer, here's what's weird, okay? So I had all these weird spiritual experiences along the way. I thought I knew AA and the steps and how things work, okay? And I would be sitting in meetings, even though I'd been out for 4 years, I'd been sitting in meetings and I would listen to people share. I'd be like, oh, I know that already about that step. I know that. Oh, that's right. That's how you do it. Or I would judge people share, like, oh, I have more recovery than that person, right? But when I did my third step prayer with her, what's weird is like, after that, I totally forgot any recovery I had. Seriously, it was magical. And I would sit in meetings and I would be stupid, like blessedly stupid. And I was just empty. And I would just listen. And I was just, and it was, it took me about a little less than a year to get through the steps that I remember getting really depressed. And she was phrasing it like, taking the third step. Because things just started coming undone in my life after I took the first step. Things just were coming undone. And, I still had this belief that, well, I got sober, things are supposed to be better. And, but she said, it's like that you have to liken it to the hunter following the moose. So the hunter has shot the moose and now it's bleeding out and it wants to die, but it's fighting. It's fighting so hard. And she's like, you're the moose, like you're fighting, so you don't want to die, like the self is going to fight. But what you really are is like the hunter behind it. You're the consciousness behind that. And you're losing all this because you're being constructed for something else. And it was so true. And I'm so glad I held on and had her powerful message and experience to hang on to, because there were days I couldn't even get out of bed. It was the depression was so bad. But meetings opened up again, and by the time I got to step 10, 11, and 12, I've never lost that. The way that I practice step 10 now, it's not so mechanical. Like I've learned how to like zoom out, and this is what I teach women. My alcoholism centers in my mind, right? It's my twisted thought life, right? That I'm always thinking negatively, worst case scenario. I'm just always thinking in bad ways, okay? For me to have a happy life and emotional sobriety, at some point, I need to be like enough and have the discipline to be willing to discipline my mind through these steps. Okay, there's no more, acting all naive. Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know. No. And when I practice this, like especially, implementing morning meditation in my life and that watchfulness and the 10 steps, so I can feel any certain way, but I don't have to identify with it, right? It's like I can have a step back and I can practice a pause because I could see, I could feel it in my body. I could see what's going on, but I'm not so identified as it. I'm the consciousness behind it. And I tell you what, this has made my life so much better. I mean, I can't say enough about the benefits of emotional sobriety because what I'm like now, so I told you what happened, what I was like, what happened. I am a totally different woman now, okay? I promise you. Now, I am not perfect. I do not practice this perfectly. I don't know anybody that does, okay? But there's nowhere to arrive, right? And I'm not interested in performances. I care less about looking good to anybody in AA or anybody else than about having peace in my soul and showing up for my kids the way I do, right? When my daughter was in the ninth grade, she didn't want anything to do with me when I got sober this time. These steps have made it so that she calls me all the time now. Like we are so, she's so, she trusts me so much, right? And it's like, it's such a blessing. Like, I feel like I got off the elevator early enough. I mean, the mother that I am to those kids now, because it was so different. And here's what's crazy. It's like when we first get here, when I first got here, I had no idea how good it could get. Like, truly, I had no idea. And it just gets better, seriously. And I'm not just saying, it's not to say that my life is always great and I don't have like the normal struggles people have, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't need to look perfect on the outside for me, right? Like, I have these steps, I have God, I have these spiritual principles, and perfecting and enlarging my spiritual life now is the bright spot and priority of my life. And right now, where I'm at, I'm trying to, I love who I am today, honestly. And it's a good thing because I hated who I was most of my life. I hated who I was when I got in here. I hated the woman that alcohol asked me to be. And it's just so different now. Like, I feel clear. I can show up at work and this faith, like, I have so struggles that I have today. I'm sponsoring women now and I'm trying to learn how to be an effective sponsor. It's been, I didn't start really getting a lot of women until like last year. So it's been like a lot of trial and learning like what's best because what I'm up against is I do want to pass this on, okay? But also I like to be left alone. So I've made like, a lot of mistakes. There's been firings on both ends, but I feel like I'm like getting like in a better groove now about just discernment, like what this actually is. I've had to, it's been a process, this recovery of undoing a lot of stuff that was programmed into me from AA culture, like stuff, well-meaning stuff that you hear in meetings from people that's very well-meaning, but it's actually not in our big book. It's actually, let me think of an example. Like, you can't trust your own thinking. Don't trust your thinking, right? Stuff like that that's well-meaning. It's not the purpose of this work for me is this 11-step promise, right? That my thinking will become more and more on the plane of inspiration. Okay. That's what I'm trying to get to. I'm trying to get to where I can trust my thinking and my connection with God. So there's a space where maybe that's appropriate very early on, but that's actually very damaging and disempowering to be telling a woman my experience, like, don't trust your thinking. You don't know what you're doing. Just sit down and shut up. It's like, I'm very big on, because what was taught to me is we need to find out what do these spiritual principles mean to you, right? Because I've had my experience and I'm continuing to have my own experience. So I help teach these women, like, you're going to have your own experience with the power. We're not training you to have my experience or the cool person in AA's experience. Like, this is unique to you. So find out what these spiritual principles mean to you. In meetings, like, start paying attention to that, like, tapping into your intuition. If you hear something that doesn't feel true, even though this person has 20 years and is super awesome, if they're saying something and you're like, I don't like that, listen to that. You don't have to pick up everything that every freaking person says in AA. Like, we're in the book. Like, we're using this mystical text. And my experience is it is a mystical text because it changes as I change, right? It meets me where I am. And I'm constantly, like, learning new things about it. It's powerful, right? I truly believe that, and I've heard this analogy, that recovery is like an escalator going downwards, right? I have to keep going up, right, to be even. Or look at it this way. Alcoholism is still in me. It's always growing. It's always growing, okay? As I perfect and enlarge my spiritual life through this work, the daily disciplines that are outlined in the steps, I grow spiritually, right? So it just cancels each other out. So I'm just like shoulder to shoulder. I'm just here. I get to feel normal for a little bit, right? Be useful. I get to be a pass-through for God's love. That's what the spiritual awakening is to me, to become a pass-through so that I could pass this on or be used by God in whatever situation I am. So alcoholism is growing. My spiritual life is growing. So alcoholism is going to keep growing. Now, if I stop, alcoholism is going to keep growing anyway, right? And then that's what happened to me. And it's just going to, like, take over and make me feel terrible again. And, maybe drink. I don't know. So I'm really in a place, I'm 47. And like I said, I've had a lot of death around me. So I know my time here is finite. I want peace. Okay. I just want to live differently. I want good people around me. I'm always looking for people who can. I do struggle to find people who are just naturally spiritually minded, honestly, even in the program, because I find most people by and large just are not spiritually minded. So I've had to get creative. I go to this AA Zoom meeting in Canada at 11 o'clock on Wednesdays, and I befriended this woman in Texas that has 27 years. And we just had our first phone conversation yesterday, and we were talking about spiritual literature, and I just really cherish those moments because it's just hard to find that. And it just nourished me and it inspired me and it gives me another dose to, like, keep going. Because I am the alcoholic who needs a message of depth and weight. I just do. I'm not going to do well with some, just don't drink, go to meetings. Like, I just really, it's important for me to be around people who are actually in the disciplines, in the steps, having a spiritual experience, growing their relationship with God. And that's just what's important to me now. And I never want to look back. I mean, this is just what this has given me is, I honestly just don't even have words, but I am immensely grateful. And I live in a space now where anything can happen. I don't know, like, right? It's like anything can happen. I'm not living in gloom and doom. I'm gonna be homeless next week. Because even if I was, I'd be okay. That's the thing. Like, we can get there. So it's actually pretty amazing. So thank you for listening to me.
Yeah,
That's all.
thank you.